has beautiful satellite reception if the dish can look into clear blue sky. If that dish has to look through one branch of one tree to get that signal, and you would think the branch is creating the attenuation, and yes it does, but there's a much stronger thing the branch creates. Radio-wise, that branch is a bright emitter of radio waves, believe it or not. That's the method by which it interferes with that satellite signal. So you got to make sure it sees pure blue sky. And in my case, my 12-foot diameter dish that I was using for direct satellite reception, TVRO it was called in the old days, television receive only terminal, because I've got 85-foot high trees on my property, I had to mount that dish 65 feet in the air on the side of the radio tower in order to get good reception with that dish to clear the trees. And even then, I couldn't see the lower satellites, which allowed me to watch the Alaskan satellite, because I wanted to watch a program in those days called Learn Alaska, and I wanted to watch some of that stuff. As it is, I did watch a number of beautiful Canadian programs by watching their satellite TV, and the Halifax people that put out some very interesting television programs. Let me drop. I can't think of the name of the Canadian broadcasting systems channel that's in Halifax, but they would start off every single morning with a man with a camera on his shoulder, starting off at the seafront and walking from the seafront into the studio with the camera. That was the beginning of their program, their television program every morning. Fascinating stuff. Or when you watch the Inuk news and you listen to their method of speaking, and I made a tape recording of that and showed it to my savvy friends who thought they were world travelers. And I said, what language do you think they're listening to? And they couldn't come up with an answer. Very unusual sounding language. So satellite television gives you some beautiful signals. And does all of that have to be carefully grounded? As you can see, there's a mixed answer to that. But you and I are thinking immediately about the pieces of metal we put up in the air. And we assume immediately it's going to be a big attractor for lightning. Not necessarily. Over to you, for us, N2FRB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, K2RIW and 2FRB. Okay, Dick, I wasn't sure if it was directly DC grounded, but I figured it was some kind of way it was grounded of some way. But I was not sure. That was a curiosity of mine, and I appreciate the answer. I myself do not have a dish on my building. I'm not allowed to have any type of antenna on this building, which is the reason why I'm trying to make up a good movie, and I'm going to go over to the manager of the company that manages this building and show them that they have an antenna on the building that's for a master antenna system, and I want to plop another antenna on top of that for a regular log periodic antenna for VHF. Anyway, that was my question. I appreciate the answer, Dick. Thank you very much. I enjoy listening to the TechNet, and I will be continuing listening to the TechNet. Back over to you. K2RAW and 2FRB.
Hey, John, we got an enthusiast there. We've got to send him a bill. That's a joke. Yeah, but to repeat, the coaxial cable that feeds B plus up to your satellite receiver, if you had one in the era of direct satellite television, direct TV type. The coaxial cable, the shield of it, provides the grounding, as well as one of the conductors that, by way of the center conductor, gives you the 12 or 18 volts that goes to that converter to make it work. So you send B plus up, you send it 12 or 18 volts to make it go to horizontal and vertical polarization, it sends you a signal back down that you're back on top of the set, so to speak, converts that down to channel 3 in some cases, so you can get direct TV reception, or converts it into direct video and audio. Now, when it comes to grounding antennas, the guy on Long Island who has the biggest grounding problem I know of is Eric, KE2EJ, chief engineer of channel 13 at the Empire State Building in New York City, and channel 21 out in Syosset, I think it's Syosset, near exit 49, I think it is. Anyhow, does he have a grounding problem? You got 330 feet of radio tower on a piece of 220 Shanghai Land out here on Long Island. Is that a lightning attractor? Absolutely. That's the tallest thing around, and I guarantee it gets struck a few times. And I think Eric has even told me about being in the broadcast studio at one time and hearing the sounds of what you hear inside of this metallic building when lightning strikes that antenna. KE2EJ, I know I got you off subject. K2RIW, go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, it gets whacked a lot, actually. Although this summer, I think we only got hit once. Last summer, I think I got hit like 3 or 4 dozen times. And then we didn't have that much lightning storm activity this summer, for whatever reason. It's more annoying out here than it was, say, in the World Trade Center. In the World Trade Center, the building itself, like, you barely heard anything. It's quite loud, and the compression of the air, you know, the percussion that it makes when it hits, the differential in air pressure is absolutely amazing. You hear it for a while, so to speak. Anyway, I want to move on to my question, okay, Nick?
Roger, Dodger, Eric. And Eric, you could use a little bit more audio. You're about 3 dB down. Very clean sounding signal, but a little bit quiet. Yeah. Your audio, I'm going to try to duplicate the audio so you know what it sounds like, because I'm hearing what's coming back.
It sounds
about this loud as your audio. So it could be a bit louder. Over to you, Eric. K2LAW.
K2LAW, K2J. Is this more satisfactory?
Yeah, I asked for 3 dB more audio and you gave me 9.25. That's a little overdone, but go ahead, Eric.
Alright, over the past couple of weeks, I've listened to you talk about antennas that are either too long or too short. So it got me thinking, and I wanted to do a little mental exercise. And what I basically want to talk about is a Hertzian doublet, or a simple doublet, or an elementary doublet, a theoretical dipole. Okay, I've been able to work out the closed form expression to calculate the electric field, the magnetic field, and display them in spherical coordinates, you know, actually create a picture of it, and the same thing for the far field. Now, the thing that I'm interested in right now is that I've been going through the various equations, and not that I don't really quite understand this, but I want to get a few words from you in terms of radiation resistance, gain, and aperture, and what would you call the impedance of free space. So maybe you can give me a little insight to that, because we're talking about theoretical gain here, and to make all things equal, we're going to assume that there's no ohmic losses in this process. So we're looking for, actually, in the end, radiation resistance, directivity, and the effective aperture. K2RIW, KE2EJ.
My goodness, have you asked a question, Eric? And a thorough answer, which you're not going to get, will go on for a fraction of a lifetime. And I'm going to warn you, half of what I'm going to tell you is very controversial material that works for me. Using the philosophy you're about to hear, I've come up with 30 patent applications, 21 of which have already been issued by the patent office, and about 6 or 7 of them are in manufacturing process today. They're being used on a daily basis, these antennas. That beautiful great big equation on what is the exact impedance for a dipole, where if you feed into the equation the diameter of the wire, the length of the wire, whether or not there's any surrounding nearby materials or whatever, a very big complicated equation that you'll find in the antenna engineering handbook under the subject of dipoles. You would like to believe that that fancy looking equation was a direct derivation of something. Absolutely not. Let me drop it. The dirty little secret is that antenna is an empirical derivation. By that I mean somebody did a whole bunch of measurements and came up with an equation that is a curved fitting that approximately fits the data. And why go two steps downrange away from the horse's mouth? The horse's mouth, in my opinion, is the Brown and Woodward curves. You go to any of the latest versions. There's now four editions of the Antenna Engineering Handbook. You go to edition number 2, 3, and 4, and you go to chapter 4. If you go to edition number 1, 1960, Henry Jasek, and I worked with him, by the way, there it was in chapter 1. You go to the so-called Brown and Woodward curve. There are two separate curves. And by the way, you can easily find those curves by going to a website that I had something to do with. You go to Tom Williams' website, WhiskeyAlpha1MikeBravoAlpha.org. WhiskeyAlpha1MikeBravoAlpha.org is microwave website. You go to the bottom of the page, and you'll find the dipole information by K2LIW, and there you will see a reproduced copy of the Brown and Woodward curves. Let me drop. One of those curves is giving you the resistive impedance versus length of the wire, regardless of diameter of the wire. There's probably 15 separate curves on that page for 15 separate diameters of wire. So length of the wire is the horizontal axis. Resistive component is the vertical axis. Brown and Woodward, way back in 1948, spent a man year of their life taking various diameters of wire, putting it above a perfect ground plane, and making a real impedance measurement. In those days, they had to do it with a slotted line, a slide rule, and a whole lot of calculations. They didn't have computers. They didn't have a vector network analyzer. They did it the hard way. But that's real hard data, the real stuff. And the equations that you think you're plugging in your dipole impedances and radiation patterns to really came from that work. So go to the horse's mouth. So one of those curves gives you the resistive component. The other curve gives you the reactive component for every possible dipole you're ever going to build. Bear in mind that those curves are for a monopole. And by the way, there's 1,500 words that goes along with it at the Tom Williams site that I wrote. That'll tell you how to really use the curve. The bottom line is that any length of dipole can very easily be impedance matched in a predictable, deterministic manner by way of all the hard work those guys did. Any reasonable dipole and length you're ever going to choose for the rest of your life is on one of those curves. And that's the real measured data, not somebody's fancy curve-fitting equation, which, by the way, some people will immediately say, gee, this curve, this term doesn't make much sense, I'm going to drop it out, and this term doesn't make much sense, I'm going to drop it out. And they get up all kinds of errors. Let me drop. So now, if I take a particular example, ordinarily, an 80-meter dipole should be 132 feet long, pieces of 14-gauge wire strung 50 feet in the air, and that's the way a good halfway dipole on 80 meters or 75 meters would be built. And now if you suddenly start deciding that, hey, I'm going to make that dipole not 132 feet long, I'm going to make it 80 feet long, 60 feet long, 30 feet long, 21 feet long, can I re-resonate the dipole? Absolutely. By way of the Brown and Woodward curve, you'll know exactly what resistive component you're going to get. You'll know exactly what reactive component you're going to get. Therefore, one very simple L network, one inductor and one capacitor, will give you the impedance match at that frequency for that crazy length of dipole. And where do you find out what inductor and capacitor you should use? You go to the Berkeley equation. You Google the word Berkeley, B-E-R-K-E-L-E-Y, and impedance. You put the two words on the search for Google for Berkeley and impedance match by way of the Brown and Woodward curve for your crazy length of dipole. I don't care if it's 14 wavelengths long or 1/14th of a wavelength long. The Brown and Woodward curve will tell you what impedance you're going to get. You tell the Berkeley website what impedance you're starting off with your single generator, transmitter. What impedance is your load, antenna. You plug those numbers into Berkeley. You press go, and Berkeley, in a fraction of a second, will give you 16 solutions, and I'm not kidding, maybe it's 14, that give you 16 solutions for very simple L networks, L pi networks, pi L networks, and so on. You choose the one that you like, and there is the answer. Now, what do you get? First of all, the fanciest puzzle, you can take any antenna expert that you know, who has been through the American and maybe even repeater.
Time out.
You take any antenna expert you know. I don't care if he's been through a European school, an American school, an Australian school, a Japanese school. And the way we teach antenna design is almost dead wrong, in my opinion. The most basic antenna is a dipole or a monopole. A dipole is a pair of monopoles back to back. And as I was starting to tell you, those Brown and Woodward curves are for a monopole. For every impedance you read off the curve, if it's the resistive component for your dipole, you double it, because your dipole is a pair of monopoles back and forth, and back to back. The Brown and Woodward curves are for monopoles. Take the impedance component and double it before you use it. Anyhow, every antenna we build has, in many cases, the basic component that makes the antenna work is a monopole or a dipole. In the case of a Yagi antenna or a log periodic antenna, the thing that sets off the radiation is a dipole-like driven element. In the case of your waveguide antennas, the waveguide, the coax adapter, has a little probe inside of the waveguide. That is a monopole antenna inside the waveguide. So in the beginning of the real process of operation, where the rubber meets the road, the ground, the bedrock of almost all of our antennas is a dipole or a monopole. Therefore, anybody who's got any curiosity about antennas at all, what's really happening, he wants to really know how a dipole works. You take your favorite antenna engineer, you give him this very simple puzzle. Because the dipole in this example is exactly a half wavelength long, it has a resistive component of impedance of 72 ohms approximately, and no reactive component. Assuming you're feeding it with balanced 72 ohm twin lead, coming from a balanced 72 ohm transmitter, everything is perfect. You know the signal coming out of the transmitter is going to flow down the twin lead once, hit the antenna, and none of it's going to come back. This wire will be 1.1 to 1. Therefore, it's the ideal condition. And you ask him this very simple problem. That is, the antenna has been working continuously, and I choose one particular wave coming out of the transmitter. And whether you consider the wave a bundle of electrons, whether you consider it a certain number of joules of energy, whether you consider it a certain amount of current, a certain amount of volts, whatever units you want to use, there's one particular cycle coming out of the transmitter at this instant, and in this Gedanken experiment, you're now going to mentally tell me what happens. You slowed down the movie, you watched that one particular single cycle go down the transmission line, you watched it hit the antenna, and then you tell me what happens next. You say that to an antenna engineer, and he'll say to you, why the hell do I want to know that? And the answer you're going to give him is, because that is the basic operation of every antenna we know about. If you don't understand that, you're not sure what's really happening. We all want to believe that energy goes down that transmission line, hits the antenna, and jumps into space. Absolutely, positively not. The signal, to radiate a signal from an antenna is extremely difficult. You're going to resonate the antenna first, then it can radiate. Why do you resonate it? Electronically or mechanically, you're going to resonate the antenna. Because that signal, you know that the dipole has got a Q of around 10 or 20.
Repeater, time out.
All the good books will tell you that that antenna has a Q of 10 or 20. That's a fancy way of saying the signal is going to bounce back and forth. The energy you're putting into the dipole is going to bounce back and forth on the dipole 10 or 20 times before it finally gets radiated in space. When the signal goes down that wire the first time, 5% of it gets radiated. It hits the end and bounces back. The reason why you resonate the antenna is because if you know that it's going to have 10 or 20 bounces, you want to keep all of those bounces co-phase, in step with each other. That's why you resonate it. If you don't, you get very little radiation. And by the way, in the process of the signal bouncing back and forth 20 times, you're building up extra current. The definition of Q is how much voltage rise you get at resonance or how much current rise you get at resonance. If the antenna has a Q of 20, then the current is somewhere in the antenna is going to be 20 times higher than the current that you launch down the transmission line. 20 times higher current is 20 times stronger magnetic field, and that's what really sets off the radiation. So whether you resonate it by way of a tuning network at the base of the antenna or within the antenna itself because you've made the physical length the right half wavelength, that's your choice. Let me drop. Now, once it's radiated, once it's resonant, and as long as you've built it out of low-loss materials,
99.9% of the energy you put into the antenna will eventually be radiated into space. And now, the quickest question everybody will now ask is, if I built that 80-meter dipole instead of 132 feet long, I made it 31 feet long, what happened to the effective capture area? Everybody thinks the captured area went to zero. Absolutely not. The captured area within half a dB never changed. As long as you resonate the antenna, the gain is the same. The pattern gets a tiny bit fatter. That's where the half dB of difference came. The half dB of loss, by the way, in gain, is not loss in the I squared R manner. It's loss because the figure eight pattern became a little, or the donut pattern, if you think in three-dimensional space. The pattern became a little bit broader because you made it super short. That's where the half a dB of difference in broadside gain is. So the infinitesimal dipole, you take a look at the best book on antennas that was ever written in the early days, 1950, McGraw-Hill, a book by John Krauss called Antennas. And you look at the chapter on the infinitesimal dipole, the area of capture area and the gain is almost the same. Brown and Woodrow will tell you how to resonate it, how to impedance match it. You have to know that the gain stays the same. By the way, when you make the dipole 31 feet long instead of 132 feet long, instead of it having a Q of 20, the Q will be 200. Therefore, it's much more difficult to hit the resonance. The impedance, the resistive component, it becomes a much smaller number. Brown and Woodward curve will tell you that. The reactor starts building up real fast. The amount of work your L network has to do to resonate it is pretty hard. The signal is going to bounce back and forth 200 times. And therefore, even though it is smaller in physical size, the effective capture area of transmitting and receiving is essentially the same. Ain't that crazy? Of course it's opposite of common sense, but the whole process of radiation is opposite.
Repeater, time out.
The whole process of radiation is opposite of common sense. The way we teach antenna engineering in all of the schools I know about, it is so far left of center that the average antenna, the average wireless engineer, a guy who went to a bachelor school or a master's school, and he studied communications and wireless communications in particular, and he comes out of the school with this fresh certificate in his hand that he's now got that degree, and you ask him to design an antenna, 90-some-odd percent of those guys cannot do it. The school didn't teach them how to do that. And that's really sad, because you and I can have a gold-plated transmitter, a perfect receiver, and if you don't connect it to an antenna, you've got nothing. You're not on the air. To put it the right way around, if you put the horse before the cart, you're going to design the antenna first, because that's what really does the wireless work, and then you're going to hang some electronics on it. In the case of an airborne radar, you better do it that way, or you're going to go down the tubes. Design the antenna first, then hang the electronics on it before you try to fly that airborne radar. So now, as you make your long wire antenna, you decide to make your dipole instead of half wavelength long, you start making it three-quarter, one wave, one and a half waves, 14 waves long. You now develop more and more lobes in space. The pattern does get a little bit more complicated, and the particular lobe that is broadside for the first time does go higher in gain. When you go to multiple wavelengths. To make an antenna have gain in the real world, it must have real estate. The gain comes from real estate. Let me drop. In the case of a horn or a dish antenna, your eye can easily see the real estate. You double the area of a horn, it will have 3 dB more gain. You double the area of a dish, it will have 3 dB more gain. You double the length of a dipole, and you will have on its main lobe more gain for the first time, and you will have some other lobes which are very predictable as to where they're going to be. So until you add a hell of a lot of real estate, you don't get more gain. But if your reference is the halfway dipole, and you go in the other direction, you slowly start moving down toward smaller and smaller dipoles, the effective capture area and the gain does not decrease as long as you re-resonate it. Say those words on 20 meters on Saturday afternoon, you'll get a hell of a lot of people jumping down your throat saying, what in the world are you smoking? Because what they've been hearing for years is something else. They've heard it so many times, they're positive it's true. It ain't true. Let me drop. And one of the things thing I should tell you before I pass it back to you, Eric, and that is you look at that Brown and Woodward curve. You choose the right length of the wire. You can get any resistive impedance you desire between 1 ohm and 1,000 ohms or 2,000 ohms inclusive. If you're using 147 ohm impedance transmission line and you want the resistive component of your antenna to be 147 ohms, the Brown and Woodward curve will tell you exactly how long to make the antenna to get that exact resistive impedance. You don't have to use fancy gamma match, T match, and all those other mechanical structures to get the impedance you want. Choose the right length of the dipole, and the resistive component will be exactly what you want. How many people know that? That's an extremely well-kept secret. And once you choose that particular length that gives you the resistive component you want, there will always be a reactive component left over. A simple reactor put in parallel or in series with the feed terminals of the antenna makes the reactive component go away, and now you've got a perfect impedance match. And the thing will always look like a dipole. You don't have to go to all these other fancy structures. As I said, this is controversial material. You now know the secret that is not taught in any of our schools. KE2EJ, KQRIW.
KQRIW, KQJ. Now, a lot of what you're saying really makes a lot of sense. As I relate it back to, one thing that we don't talk about really, what you should be saying, is that, first of all, it's an alternating current. So, we need a couple of components to make this work. And one, of course, is frequency, the length of the wire. And when we calculate it up, and I think what it is 2 pi f, is actually becomes the angular frequency. We never talk about this. And the fact that, you know, we're talking vectors here, is a phasor. And to make that work, we need that imaginary unit to the inverse. I think it's the square root of minus 1. And then when we look at it from the point of, I've taken all these equations and did symbolic simplification, and basically comes out to 2 pi over 3 times the, whatever the free space impedance is, times the square of the length of the wire over a wavelength. And as you are talking, it's beginning to make sense in my head, mathematically, where you're going with this. And as you reduce the length of the radiator, it's beginning to make sense.
Everyone wants to believe, Eric, that you're adjusting the dipole impedance in order to impedance match it to space. That's a philosophy. I'm not convinced the philosophy works, because if I'm building a dipole at 80 meters, it's 132 feet long, and it matches space, 377 ohms per square. If I'm building the dipole at 10 gigahertz, the dipole is a half inch long, and it matches the free space, 377 ohms. How can the shorter dipole impedance match the space as the longer dipole when you change the frequency? The free space has got nothing to do with it, in my opinion. It is a theoretical abstraction. To some degree, it doesn't exist. For something to have an impedance, it's got to be a real substance. It's a chunk of plastic. It's a chunk of Teflon. It's a piece of air. It's a vacuum or whatever. It's got to be a real substance to have a real Z0, so to speak. Free space has no conductor. There's no electrons per se. Not a single electron leaves that antenna. Nothing but a magnetic field leaves the antenna. When you and I are impedance matching the antenna, we're impedance matching the fact that we drop.
Now, it doesn't matter where. I mean, everything that I've read, it always says that the impedance of free space is 4 times the radiation resistance. That just doesn't make sense to me.
Whoever said that to you, Eric, is talking about a particular philosophy of designing antennas and explaining what Mother Nature does. To talk about the impedance of free space, if I was building an optical device and I'm taking an optical wave and now making it impinge onto a resistive material, and I set the resistive material to be some fraction of 377 ohms per square, I will get the maximum absorption of that optical wave under that material. I'll get the maximum heating, and many of the optical detectors are really a thermal detector. Well, that's not the way you and I build a radio antenna. We don't build a thermal sensor on that antenna. We're looking at the voltage, the current, what appears as a amount of energy flowing down a transmission line. But what impedance matching really is how much, what percentage of the signal went down the dipole, hit the insulator at the end, and reflected back. If 95% of it came back out of phase, because it went a quarter wave down, a quarter wave back, by the time that signal comes back, it's now out of phase with the new signal coming down the transmission line. What percentage of cancellation you get at that point, on that first bounce, so to speak, is what determines the impedance you see. Therefore, the impedance of the antenna goes up and down as you adjust the length, because as you adjust the length, more or less of the signal got a chance to be radiated, and that energy is not there in the bounce back. What really happens in the free space, and the impedance of free space, is secondary. It's a philosophy, but it doesn't help you on the real design, in my opinion. What you really want to know... What you really want to know is what percentage of the energy is no longer there, and it can't come back to give you cancellation. If you build your dipole inside of a shielded structure by making your dipole out of the ordinary RGA cable center conductor, but you left the shield on so that now none of the signal can radiate. This is Ideal Airline Andrew Heliak's, and none of the signal can radiate on that half-wave dipole inside of my Andrew Heliak's. So the signal goes down to the end. None of it got radiated. All of it comes back. I measure the impedance. The impedance will look like 0 ohms. If I create some holes in the side of the Andrew Heliak so that it's now radiax, and some of the signal got radiated on the way down and on the way back, now the impedance starts climbing up above 0 ohms. What you think is impedance match, and you think you're matching the 377 ohms of free space, has got nothing to do with it. What percent of the energy is no longer there to come back and give me voltage cancellation at the feed point of the antenna, that's the impedance you see. Ain't that crazy? Over to you, Eric. KQLIW.
Actually, no, that's not crazy. Even John's experiment plays into this. I mean, if I put, let's say I put a terminator, let's go purely resistive at the end of the coax, forget about the antenna for a second, or if I put a short and I reflect 100% of the energy back, I can still, in essence, tune that out with a device with what I'm feeding it with. I can make that forward-going energy in phase with the reverse energy. It's going to add at that point. You know,
we can
turn it into heat, but we can still make a perfect impedance match. Yeah?
Any length of wire is going to give you at your particular frequency a particular resistive and reactive impedance. The Brown-Woodward curve will tell you exactly how much resistance, exactly how much reactance. The Berkeley website will tell you exactly how to set up a single inductor and a single capacitor as a L network to give you a perfect impedance match at that frequency for your length of wire. And even though your dipole is very short, it still, with resonance, will radiate all the signal. Therefore, its transmitting gain, per se, didn't change. And because of the law of reciprocity, whatever area it had for transmitting, it's got the exact same area on reception. It's hard to believe. And here's a real hard example. A full-wave dipole on 80 meters, 132 feet long. You plug in the formula is that the area is gain lambda squared over 4 pi. That's one of the bedrock equations of the antenna science. Area is gain lambda squared over 4 pi. Make sure your lambda and your... make sure you use the same set of units everywhere. And you do that to an 80-meter dipole. It has an area of 8,500 square feet is the radio area of a full half-wave dipole on 80 meters. At high noon, the sun is shining on your 14-gauge wire, 132 feet long. It's casting a shadow on the ground of 1 square foot. If your eyes operated at 80 meters and you looked into that dipole broadside from a long distance away, you would see, let me drop. You would see this great big black oval in space. which is a little bit more than a half wavelength wide and a little bit less than around a third wavelength high, this great big black oval in space where any of the 80-meter signal with the same polarization on that frequency who enters the area of the antenna, that black area is where the signal is being sucked up, goes down the wire, goes down the transmission line, and pegs the US meter. That's the real radio area. Your eye sees 1 square foot. The radio wave, because of resonance, sees 8,500 square feet. You take that 80-meter dipole, 132 feet long, you make it 31 feet long and re-resonate it. Within half a dB, it still has 8,500 square feet of radio area. And you'll say to yourself, how the hell can it do that? Well, that signal is bouncing back and forth 200 times on that short dipole because of the much higher Q. It's got a much more narrow bandwidth. In other words, you tune 100 KC now, and you've got to retune your antenna. Maybe you tune 30 KC, and you've got to retune it. It's a much higher Q, more narrow band antenna. But because of the resonance, it's now making this huge local magnetic field. Therefore, it recreates that exact same area. Ain't that crazy? You say those words on 20 meters, again, they'll say, what in the world are you smoking? Didn't the area go to zero when I make the length of the dipole zero? Answer is absolutely not. If you're smart enough to re-resonate it, you keep getting that area back on transmission and reception. It ain't easy. It ain't good common sense. If you slowly come to accept that, you'll be amazed what you can do with it. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Looks like I got a little more calculating. K2RIW, K2EJ. So really, in terms of the real world, it's really now all a matter of the network that I put together and the ability to control the values, to keep those values tight. As the Q goes up, as the length of the antenna gets smaller, I'm going to have more accuracy in controlling the reactors, the inductive and capacitive reactors, of how I make the match. Isn't that true?
Absolutely right, but don't let that scare you into submission, Eric. As you make that dipole 31 feet long instead of 132 feet long, it used to be almost 500 KC wide, 3.5 to 4.0 megahertz, probably is where you hit the 3 to 1 VISWA, and now you've made it 31 feet long, and as you go to those two ends of the band, instead of you seeing a 3 to 1 VISWA, you're going to see a 300 to 1 VISWA. And every time you tune 20 KC up the band, you're going to readjust the antenna tuner. If you're trying to choose the value of the inductor and the capacitor of the L network, or the inductor and the two capacitors of a pi network, and you're trying to choose them accurately to work with the shorter dipole, yes, it's a much higher accuracy requirement. Don't let that scare you, because we amateurs are tinkerers. Whenever you and I build an impedance matching network or a pi network, something in there is a variable. You've got a C1 and a C2 capacitor, the tuning and loading capacitor on your pi network of your antenna tuner. And so if you didn't hit it exactly right, you twist the knob a little bit and you hit the resonance and you're there. So although it's got to be more accurate, because you and I are willing to do adjusting, and while we're doing the adjusting, while we're doing the adjusting, we're using our Berg wattmeter and we're looking at reflected power on the transmitter side of the antenna tuner, and we adjust the controls on the antenna tuner so that the reflected power goes to zero. The transmitter will see a 1-to-1 VISWA, even though the transmission line, which better be an open wire line, by the way, sees a 300-to-1 standing wave ratio. You and I are going to adjust those controls to make the impedance hit, and therefore we automatically find the we find that accurate component. It's a little bit like a sight-impaired person walking up a hill. His feet can tell him which way is uphill, and he knows which way to go. You and I operate that control. We rock it back and forth. We find out which direction makes the standing wave ratio go lower, and we keep going in that direction, and we hit 1-to-1. So don't be scared about the fact you need more accuracy. You and I can easily get there. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
Now, experience tells you that. K2LIW, K2EJ. Well, I'm saying, if we've got an 80-meter dipole, we only want to use, say, 5 feet of wire or 10 feet of wire. The practical reality is, if I have a roller inductor or I'm using variable capacitance, how much effect does the heat have in terms of the major change in capacitance, how much vibration these things affected. Are we talking about capacitance that makes the difference in the resonance between, say, 0.0001 microfarad and 0.00011 microfarad? That's where I was getting at. As we make the length of the antenna smaller, the tolerances of the components that we're going to be using have to get tighter.
To use the word tolerance, I would rather use the word efficiency. As you start making the dipole infinitesimal in length, following the philosophy of the infinitesimal dipole out of Carse's book on antennas, the first edition, and I think they kept those chapters in the later ones, but I'm not sure, and Carse is up to third edition at least, not the fourth. Anyhow, because the Q of the network, by the way, the radiating network, the thing that you and I call antenna, we like to believe that piece of wire that we call dipole is the antenna. Well, yes and no. It is a radiating structure. It is a component of the radiating structure. The radiation structure consists of the thing you and I call antenna, Yagi, dipole, monopole, ground plane, whatever, the balancing and impedance matching device that feeds it, the transmission line that feeds it, the tank circuit of the transmitter is part of the radiating structure. Assuming you've got low-loss transmission line, you're going to resonate that whole radiating structure. The tank circuit of the transmitter, the antenna tuner, the impedance matching device if there is one, the balancing device if there is one, the transmission line and the length of the transmission line, and then finding the real load, the so-called antenna. All of those components will be brought into resonance if you and I want to radiate by amateur radio standards. If 95% of the energy I'm creating is going to be radiated into space, then all of those components as one single black box, you will bring them into resonance. Let me drop. And if the world has constrained you so that you can't make the dipole big enough, and now getting into the infinitesimal dipole, and the Q is getting higher. The Q of that whole radiating structure is getting higher. You now, up to the antenna tuner and the transmission line between it and the antenna, that whole structure, if the antenna is radiating at a Q of 300, that whole structure is at a Q of 300. Your antenna tuner is now operating at a Q of 300. One of the definitions of Q is the amount of energy stored per cycle versus dissipated per cycle. If 300 times more energy is stored per cycle than dissipated per cycle, that means there's a hell of a lot more current flowing in your tank inductor and capacitors. Therefore, they better be very low in resistive component, very high in quality. Otherwise, with a Q of 300 and all of that extra energy bouncing around inside of your antenna tuner, if you've used lossy components, you're going to start getting a hot box, if you know what I mean. It's going to start to glow. So, once you recognize the fact that the antenna, by all the laws of physics of radiation that I'm now teaching you in theory, as you make the antenna smaller and the Q goes up and everything is going to be experiencing a higher Q from the antenna tuner all the way up to the antenna, you better use low-loss components for that particular Q value. And once you've accomplished that, then you can still get 99% efficiency out of that antenna tuner. The latest issue of QST Magazine in the Doctor is In section leads you to believe that 10% of the energy is lost in an antenna tuner. Absolutely not. If you've made your antenna tuner, let me drop. If you were foolish enough to make the inductor in your antenna tuner out of 18-gauge or 22-gauge wire, yes, it's going to have 10% efficiency, 10% loss. But if you use reasonable construction techniques for a good antenna tuner, similar to the Pi network, I mean, by the same token, is the Pi network and the output of my old-fashioned transmitter, is it 10% lossy? Absolutely not. You choose the right components for your particular Q you're going to operate at, and if you're smart enough, you can make the efficiency 99% every time. You just have to recognize where the minefield is, if you know what I mean. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
K2RW, K2J. Well, it's like the channel 13 transmitter that we had. It's all about the current and the current capability handling of the tank. And that thing was made out of silver bars, literally. And that was a VHF. I remember from my early days of making 200 and 300 watt transmitters. This is something that was bigger than number 10 gauge wire to make a tank out of it. It was actually big and thick. I don't know what gauge it would be. It would probably be like gauge double odd or something like that. But yeah. No, I see your point totally. If you look at some of the MMJ tuners, and you look at what they use for the band switch for the taps on the coil, with the little phenolic pieces of garbage, you know that the current have to exceed what those contacts are capable of, and that's why a lot of those things go up in smoke. All right, just give them a plane to go on. I do have a much deeper understanding of which way to go. I'm relating this to the mathematics, and something tells me I need to throw some of the mathematics out, because just as you stated, it's a philosophy. Calculating the heat field and the H field is one thing, but getting into the actual radiation in the antenna, that's a whole other game. K2RWK to the guy.
Yeah, my particular philosophy is if you think the antenna is an impedance matching device between you and free space, I think the answer is almost no. The impedance matching you're doing is between the standing wave structure that you call antenna. Standing wave structure means the signal is going to bounce back and forth a significant number of times before it finally gets radiated. And the number of times it bounces in your particular structure, because of the number of wavelengths of wire that you put out there for the dipole, so to speak, that determines the impedance. And what free space is almost got nothing to do with it. But now, for we amateurs who just love broadcasting, and we love high power, and you were in the catbird seat on that one, Eric, you sat there with a VHF analog television transmitter at channel 21, which I believe ran 50,000 watts of real power, in that order. And now you have these high Q cavities, making sure that only the correct frequency for channel 21 went out into the air, and everything else got attenuated. And you had the right group delay distortion and whatever, these very high Q cavities with 50,000 watts flowing through them. And I'm going to guess the cavity had a Q of around 1,000. Therefore, the real circulating energy inside of those cavities was close to 1,000 times higher than 50,000 real watts, really 50 megawatts was bouncing back and forth in that cavity. And those cavities got a little bit warm, but that little bit warm probably represented 100 watts of dissipation out of 50,000. And as long as you made them out of a solid bar of silver like you described and properly designed that cavity with the right kind of shielding and whatever, it took all of that 50,000 watts and with extremely high efficiency delivered it to the antenna. You've been there, you've done that, and you've seen that if you use the right materials, it doesn't have to have loss. No antenna tuner.
Repeater, time out.
What I'm saying is that no antenna tuner built with the right kind of engineering has to have any significant amount of loss. Am I numbers in the right ballpark of what you experienced, Eric, with that 50,000 watt transmitter that ran for decades, KE2EJ, K2RAW, with you watching over it?
Yeah, K2RAW, K2EJ. Actually, the dissipation was around 40 watts, and that was the UHF. What I referred to before was the VHF at the World Trade Center, which was an RCA trap. It had a 4GX 24,000 in the output. And that thing generated about 24 kilowatts. That is quite a toy. That was a lot of fun, although the high voltage was worse than the high voltage in the IoT. It was a little bit lower in voltage, but three times the current. when that thing crowbarred, the whole floor shook. That was an amazing tune. But yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Naturally, the Q of the UHF was probably around 2,000, and the amount of heat that got dissipated from the actual cavity that sucked off the output energy barely got warm. It got a little bit warm, but don't forget, it was a water tube cool tube, and the cavity around it was also water cool. So most of that excess heat got taken out and blown out into the air. But yeah, the stuff works. What can I tell you? Although you can't really fathom that the Q be that high, and yet it had a really really flat within like 0.1 of a dB bandwidth between the lower part of the channel and the upper part of the channel, which is 6 megahertz wide. K2RW, K2J.
I'm calculating right now what was your insertion loss of that cavity. 40 watts dissipation out of something like 50,000 watts. And the answer is something in the vicinity of 3 millidecibels, 0.003 decibels was the loss of your cavity running at 50,000 watts, the UHF cavity. So use the correct materials. An antenna tuner does not have to have any loss. You ask the average amateur, hey, my antenna has got a 5-to-1 Vizsla. That means half of all the power that I put into it gets reflected back to me. What does the antenna tuner do with that half of the power? If I'm running 100 watts and 50 watts is reflected back to me, what does the antenna tuner do to that 50 watts? And the answer is if it's done correctly, it wastes none of it. All of that 50 watts gets re-reflected forward and gets eventually radiated by the antenna. An antenna tuner does not have to have any loss. And that's a controversial set of words. You'd be amazed how many people will give you flack on that. One last point on this one. Let me drop. There was a significant company that I dealt with 2 years ago where the head of the antenna engineering department had working for him something like 15 separate antenna engineers that were stationed on about 5 or 6 different anechoic chambers across the real estate of that particular company. So I'm talking of the guy running the antenna department with these 15 seasoned antenna engineers, probably on average 15 years of experience on all those antenna engineers. And he happened to appear in the laboratory where I was in, and I decided to give him my antenna puzzle of the energy flowing down the twin lead to a dipole, and I asked him what happens next. And his answer was exactly those words, why the hell would I want to know that? To which my answer was, because the most basic component of almost every antenna all of your smart antenna engineers are building starts off with a monopole or a dipole. What's really happening inside of that, you want to know that. His answer was, I'll get back to you. I haven't got time to study it right now. I said, okay, I'll restate it as a email and I'll send it to you. He said, fine. I stated it as clearly as I could with diagrams and sent it to him as an email. The silence was deafening. It's not his fault. It's the way we teach our antenna engineering, the way we teach the wireless science in the United States needs a huge amount of improvement. We're way far left of center. When it comes to, let me drop. When it comes to the computer science curriculum of any well-respected college on planet Earth, that curriculum changes almost every single semester to keep it current. The engineering science, the computer science section continuously changes to keep it current. When it comes to wireless antenna design, radio frequency circuits, the Maxwell's equations, fields and wave course, we set the curriculum for that in 1947, and we haven't changed it since. What's wrong with that picture? Every one of those 20 wireless products that you've got in your pocket that control your cell phone, your remote control for the television set, your garage door opener, your wireless key operation for the car, all of those 20 products have the combination of an antenna and a computer. We make sure the computer science portion is being updated. The antenna portion of it, we don't update it since 1947. That's crazy. It's because each of the professors teaching the fields and wave course in all of our colleges don't really understand that material. They're scared to death to change it. Therefore, we keep saying, we've always done it that way. Why should we do it any other way? Let me drop. Take a guy that goes through that particular filter of that particular curriculum of that particular college, that particular wireless engineering course, and you want him to be an antenna engineer. No way in hell. If he happens to walk into a company and he happens to be smart enough to go to the antenna engineering department and work there for a few years as an apprentice, and the old white-haired guy running the department starts talking to him, and I was that lucky guy that happened to me. And that guy happened to be a guy named Henry Keene, one of the early inventors of Stripline. and Henry Keene, W2CTK, a ham radio operator running that department at Airborne Instruments Laboratory, felt sorry for this guy, K2RIW, and started talking to him. RIW was asking him questions. He was recognizing my enthusiasm and answering my questions. And that's where my apprenticeship started from. That's where it really came from. There's a guy who's really doing it. You want an antenna engineer, you have to hire a ham radio operator because the schools do not do it. And you go to the antenna department, let me drop. You go to the antenna department of most of the companies that have an antenna department, and somewhere on one of the bookshelves of one of the seasoned engineers will be the ARRL antenna book. In most cases, it's stacked backwards in the bookcase so that you can see the pages, but you can't see the spine of the book. They're unwilling to admit that one of their main references for antenna design is a ham radio textbook. That's where the information is coming from, because the schools didn't supply it. Ain't that crazy? Isn't there need for correction? When I talked to the guys at Brooklyn Poly Institute, because one of them was working as a consultant at the company I was at, where I was also a consultant. Let me drop. And I started asking him questions about why is there no update to the method by which we teach the fields and wave course, the antenna engineering course, the wireless engineering course in the schools. And his answer was, well, the students don't have enough background to understand the mathematics. To which I said, aren't you blaming the victim? You mean to tell me you can't put it into a language that they can understand? Because you were taught that way and you're willing to not modify the way you're teaching it, you're not willing to adapt. He started getting very quiet. He started realizing what I was saying. I don't know if he made any changes, but there's a hell of a lot of change required. The way we teach the subject is almost dead wrong. Until the guy gets out in the field with 10 years of apprenticeship, he doesn't understand what wireless is, even though the schools are supposed to be teaching that. The computer science portion of the course teaches almost everything he wants to know. He can walk out of that school and earn a living doing that. No wireless engineer can walk out of that school and earn a living doing that. We got to change that. I've already been saying this for 20 or 30 years. No change has occurred yet. We're talking about a huge tradition where everyone says, this is good enough, why should I change it? It ain't good enough. Let me drop.
Let me interrupt you.
Go right ahead, Eric. I hope you've got a solution to this because I haven't found it and I'm frustrated. You got it, Eric.
I have a proposal for you, okay? You're not going to be on the planet for that much longer. I mean, you'll be around for a while, but yet you've got all this good stuff in your head. Now, I happen to be not only a video engineer, but a producer of many different kinds of programs. Why not you and I get together and let's create a video course on antennas, and let's put it on iTunes University, which absolutely nobody makes a dime off of, and it's free for anybody that wants to sit down and view it. And with the stuff that's in your head, and if you really want to make a change in the way we do things in the world, you have an opportunity to do that. What do you think about that?
Good to me. I'd be foolish to turn that one down, Eric. And yes, that's part of the solution. And I think when you're going down the road where if we create the kind of an educational, let's call it a YouTube video-like thing, where people can watch it. I mean, when you see this professor from MIT who teaches physics in a way that the students can really relate to. Wes, my mind is going blank. What's the name of that beautiful professor at MIT that you brought to our attention, his beautiful website? What's his name, Wes? Go ahead.
Professor Levine.
Say it slowly again. I'm not hearing it.
Levine, but John has better pronunciation, John.
Yeah, Levine. Levin. Good guy.
Yeah, I think I've heard this, Professor Levin. You go to any of those lectures on Professor Levin at MIT, teaching those students physics, and you listen to what he did to prepare. Each one of those presentations he gives, he has rehearsed it 3 or 4 times before the students arrive to get the bugs out of it. And he gives you these physical demonstrations. Real students with real curiosity want to be able to touch it, see it, watch it work. I mean, a bunch of fancy diagrams and three-dimensional mathematics on the board doesn't do it. You show them the real pendulum operating, the real gyroscope operating, and then give them the theory behind it, and it sticks. And so...